This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, April 27th, 2004. The formula for totalitarianism has never been the law in America. It's up to the Supreme Court to ensure that it does not become the law now. With these strong words invoking totalitarianism, the New York Times issued a very strong editorial on April 26th, Enemy Combatants in Court. This week, on Wednesday, the Supreme Court will hear arguments in two cases involving Americans who are being held indefinitely without the right to see a lawyer, and they have been designated by President Bush as enemy combatants. The Bush administration argues that the detentions are military decisions made in wartime, and the courts have no authority to second-guess them. At issue here is, are we at war, and can the president supersede the justice system? Jose Padilla and Yasser Essam Hamdi have been in a military brig for about 2 years. Neither has been charged with a crime, nor has any evidence ever been presented. Also, last week before the court were cases brought before it about foreign nationals held in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, held by the United States military, captured in Afghanistan. Today on Taking Aim, the formula for totalitarianism, torture, repression, and the martial law state. The Guantanamo case, 600 prisoners now at the Guantanamo Naval Base. Again, the challenges in the Supreme Court are over the administration's sweeping powers to hold men and boys for more than 2 years without charge or access to lawyers, free of any judicial oversight. The exercise of executive power, according to the British MPs who filed a brief in support of the Guantanamo prisoners, is without possibility of judicial review and jeopardizes the keystone of the very rule of law. Ralph?
Well, Maya, what's important about the editorial in the New York Times, which is somewhat unusual in that the Times has given rationale and justification for all of the Patriot Act measures, and in this instance, they appear to be somewhat concerned about the speed with which a virtual martial law state is being prepared. This in the context of the 9/11 hearings, which orchestrated the necessity for this. This in particular in response to the Armageddon plan of the Atlantic Monthly and the Nightline Ted Koppel extraordinary celebration of preparations to set aside Congress, set aside the Constitution, acknowledging that for 24 years Rumsfeld and Cheney have been the point men under a directive that was run by Oliver North, the secret executive order of Ronald Reagan initiating this for regular preparations for bunker running of the country from military outposts where a handful of martial law, military and intelligence officials will run the state. In that context, we see now an alarm being sounded by the New York Times. It is not mincing its words. It states, the Bush administration, ignoring basic constitutional principles, has demonstrated detentions are military decisions and courts have no authority. It states further that Padilla was without taken with almost no evidence whatsoever, charged with a crime with which he has not been able to confront any accuser or substantial evidence. And it concludes in the editorial, For the foreseeable future, any citizen anywhere at any time is subject to indefinite military detention on the unilateral order of a president. This is a formula for totalitarianism that has never been the law in America, and the sounding of the alarm is explicit. Yes, Maya.
The Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has stated categorically the position of the Bush administration. And, by the way, most Democrats have supported this position, too. He said, "Detaining people without trials seems unusual. After all, our country stands for freedom and it stands for the protection of rights." So he says, but does it really? The inclination of most Americans, Rumsfeld adds, is to think in terms of criminal law and punishment rather than the law of war, which has as its purpose first to keep the enemy off the battlefield. And off the battlefield is what the administration has been doing, creating what the British have termed a legal black hole. And Le Monde Diplomatique, in January 2004, Augusta Conchiglia published an article by Augusta Conchiglia, published a very extensive description of the Guantanamo black hole. She spent several days at the base, along with other journalists. But as she said, she could make no contact with any prisoners. In other words, they were kept at a distance. They were led by the public relations officer of the Joint Task Force. And the Joint Task Force receives its orders directly from the Pentagon. Now, the description, which you can find on the Internet at Le Monde Diplomatique, January 2004, only begins to describe the infrastructure of Guantanamo. And today, as we discuss the totalitarian structure in America, we are going to discuss what is going on behind the walls of Guantanamo. Ralph.
The black hole article in Le Monde is very graphic and very explicit. It describes the psychic war that is waged upon prisoners, plied with drugs, disorienting injections about which they are not informed, of course, which completely send them into a state of almost psychosis. This is a routinized way of breaking down the very sense of identity and individuality of the prisoners, the paradigm of the ultimate torture. And it describes rows of cells, 2 by 2.5 meters, metal mesh wards, walls and doors, the absence of privacy, solitary confinement for prolonged periods of time, an utter breakdown. Prisoners between the ages of 13 to 15 years, enemy juvenile combatants locked up in the same fashion, subject to the same treatment, people who are forced on their knees with weapons at their head, wearing face masks and earmuffs, and kept in total isolation with sensory deprivation in what is called Camp X-ray, of such extremity that dissociation is almost immediate.
Camp Delta, which is split into four quarters, she writes, can house 1,000 people. And there were 660 prisoners of 42 nationalities when she visited. It is surrounded by several metal fences covered by green nylon and topped with electrified barbed wire. The prisoners whose cells remain lit all night long are under constant surveillance by guards who patrol and are posted in watchtowers. The cells are 6 feet by 7.5 feet. Essentially, they're dog runs. Camp conditions are such that 32 suicide attempts by 21 prisoners have been logged. 6 are under observation for psychological disorders. 25 are receiving psychiatric treatment. When she had visited, another prisoner, who had been on hunger strike on and off for a year, had been committed and was being fed intravenously. In at least 3 of the 4 camps, she describes the dog runs, the cells that are 6 by 7.5 feet. The routine is only broken by solitary 20-minute walk in a large cage on a cement floor and 3 times a week by 5-minute shower. Before each transfer, prisoners are handcuffed and also fitted with foot restraints linked by chains. Only in Camp 4 were prisoners living in a dormitory situation. There were 129 prisoners in small groups in cells with up to 10 beds. And there, and only in there, were prisoners given prayer mats, as well as copies of the Quran. Now, again, there is, as Ralph mentioned, children, and they are kept isolated in what's called Camp Iguana, children 13 to 15 years of age. But also, again, the journalists were not allowed to see the prisoners. A solid wall prison is now under construction and will be completed by July 2004. And this is where prisoners who supposedly are going to be subjected to military tribunals will be held after they are inevitably convicted. And it will also include an execution chamber. Let's look and see what the actual torture that is going on in Guantanamo. And torture is what has been recorded, not in the United States, but in the British press, with the release of three of British nationals from Guantanamo. And these are Shafiq Rasool, Ruhal Ahmed, and Asif Iqbal, known as the Tipton Three because of the area in the British Midlands where they had lived. The Observer, over soon after their release, very soon after their release, in a very long interview, was able to speak with the Tipton Three. And it was published in The Observer by David Rose, Sunday, March 14, 2004. After more than 200 interrogation sessions each over the 2 years of their internment, by the CIA, the FBI, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the British MI5, MI6, and the SAS, the notorious intelligence agency operating in Northern Ireland. What these prisoners were forced to do was to admit that they had supported the Al-Qaeda, but they did so only because they had been tortured, and they say there was no foundation. Excuse me. All the intelligence agencies had to admit that their claims that the three were terrorists who supported Al-Qaeda had no foundation. In fact, they were subjecting the three to trying to get them to confess, but they had nothing to confess. But what the three said is that many people are so broken down that they do end up confessing to things that they had with which they had no relations. Ralph?
Well, one has to keep in mind that the torture did not begin in Guantanamo. The men were captured in Afghanistan, and they were there not in any military capacity, let it be clear. They were simply picked up. They survived what the Observer describes as a massacre perpetrated by U.S. Special Forces along with in charge of Northern Alliance troops. Hundreds of prisoners herded into lorry containers, locked in them. People were immediately subject to suffocation. A description of how 20 out of 300 prisoners in each container survived, and then because holes were made into the side with a machine gun, which killed yet more prisoners who were in the way of the machine gun bullets, which then penetrated the holes, creating some air supply for the survivors. The existence of a secret, super maximum secret security facility outside the main part of Guantanamo's Camp Delta, Camp Echo, is described as where prisoners are held in tiny cells in solitary confinement 24 hours a day, with military police officers permanently stationed outside each cell door. They endured 3 months of solitary confinement in Camp Delta, having gone through the ordeal of the Lorry massacre itself, which they barely survived.
The Lorry massacre, Ralph, maybe isn't known to WBAI and KPFA listeners, is the death convoy, and it's incredible. They, as they describe it, they were herded, more than 300 of us, into each container, and they were so tight, packed so tightly that their knees were against their chest, and they immediately started to suffocate. We lived because someone made holes with the machine gun, and as you mentioned, they were shooting low, and many died from the bullets. Now, they escaped the truck container massacre when they were near starvation in a jail that was run by the Afghan warlord General Dostrom. And what's interesting about General Dostrom is that he was paid for turning over people to the U.S. authorities. And first, there were weeks of physical abuse by the Americans after the General Dostrom turned them over at a detention camp in Kandahar, which we will describe later. And then they had the 2 years of desolation at Guantanamo. As we mentioned, they had been interrogated 200 sessions, and these were more than 12 hours at a time. And the evidence of what went on in this is harrowing. In Afghanistan first, let us look. They were among 35,000 prisoners, says Rasool. You'd look down the slope and there were lines and lines of people as far as the eye could see. We went through the mountains and the open desert. These were massive ditches full of bodies. We thought this was the end. They thought they were going to kill us. Many of the prisoners were wounded and died by the wayside. After this march, they were taken to Shabaran prison and crammed into the containers, of which we mentioned the containers 300 at a time. And in order to drink, they moistened, they took cloth and they took a liquid from the steaming walls. And as he said, as Iqbal said, he realized that what he was drinking was the bodily fluids of the massacred prisoners. Ralph?
Here's how it's described. He describes the massive ditches full of bodies, and then he says the massacre began under the glare of spotlights operated by American special forces. Everyone started screaming and banging. Someone had lit a fire beneath the containers. You could feel the moisture running off your body, and people were ripping on their clothes. He had not drunk, Iqbal, for more than 2 days, and it was in this circumstance, maddened by thirst, that, as you described it, he wiped the steaming walls with a cloth and sucked out the moisture, only to realize he was drinking the bodily fluids of the massacred prisoners. We were like zombies. We stank. We were covered in blood and the smell of death. All of us who wound up in Guantanamo, went through this. There were people with horrific injuries, limbs that had been shot off. Nothing was done. One man who was missing half his jaw for 10 days until his death, screaming and crying until continuously begging to be killed. And it describes how the lack of nourishment of the survivors was combined with amoebic dysentery. We were covered with lice. All day long we were scratching. I was bleeding from my chest, my head. We lost so much weight that when I stood up, I could carry water in the gap between my collarbones and my flesh. Of the 35,000 men marched through the desert by U.S. Special Forces, 4,500 remain alive, and many of those have disappeared, their fate unknown. After they were subjected to this ordeal, sandbags were put over their heads. They could see nothing. They were thrown into trucks. They taped the sacks at the bottom of our necks, and it was impossible to breathe. And the torture is endless. They were then, when they were finally brought to a single place, they were a separate space. They were made to bend double, their foreheads touching the ground. If your head wasn't touching the floor or you let it rise a fraction, they put their boots on our backs and forced our necks down. We were kept like this for hours at a time. If I lifted my head slightly because I was in such excruciating pain, a special officer would come behind, kick my legs from under me, stand on my back. They took turns kicking and punching. Soldiers took a Stanley knife, cut off the clothes. Naked and freezing, we were made to squat while our body cavities were searched and photographed. The description is harrowing and lengthy. 9 pages of detailed account of a torment, of a torture under U.S. direction, under counterterrorism and special force direction of this Kofor Black, this functionary who was testifying at the 9/11 hearings and before that at congressional hearings, gloatingly cited by George Bush, the gloves are off, nothing is in our way now. This is the record of a Hitlerian-like torment inflicted on people charged with nothing, evidentiary basis for their arrest non-existent, held after survival of this ordeal in conditions that can only be described those of concentration camps.
The three go on to describe the early days at Camp X-Ray, where they say the conditions of detention were extreme. They were forbidden from talking to the person in the next cell, and Rasul recalls they were fed only tiny portions of food. After a week, the prisoners were allowed to speak to detainees in adjacent cells, but if they didn't follow a command, there was Guantanamo's own riot squad, the Extreme Reaction Force. And Rasul says a new term was earthing. To be earthed, says Rasul, means to be slammed on the floor by a soldier wielding a riot shield, pinned to the ground, and assaulted. It's impossible to master the rules, he says, and know how to avoid punishment. There was only one rule that mattered. You have to obey whatever the U.S. government personnel tell you to do. Of the worst punishment, and what was standard, was transfer to solitary confinement in a sensory deprivation isolation wing. There, you're subject, as in all of Guantanamo, to the relentless tropical heat, with no air conditioning and only a hole in the floor for a toilet, a tap producing yellow water which was so low that you had to kneel to use it. Apart from interrogation, there was only the monotony of shower three times a week and the 20 minutes of exercise.
I have the description that is given in Part 2, How We Survived Jail Hell, by David Rose on March 14, 2004, in The Observer. The reference to those who have showers are the few who survive the ordeal or who are not confined yet to their solitary permanent isolation, and the description states the follows. Those who do confess face trial by American military commission and a death sentence awaits. Those who have been charged are no longer at Camp Delta. They are moved to the new Supermax security facility outside the main compound, Camp Echo, a white-walled, sound-absorbent hell of 24-hour solitary confinement in cells far smaller than Camp Delta's, with permanent guards stationed outside each door. The Camp Echo's current inmates say that the three men, including the Britons, Feroz Abbasi, Muazzam Beg, and David Hicks, were driven to a point where they had lost their sanity. Hicks describes how he spent all day in his isolation cell attempting to catch and kill mice to retain any form of connection with a world exterior to himself. It is an account from hell. It is a detailed account in two elaborated articles in The Observer.
Hell. You mentioned David Hicks, the Australian detainee, and he is one of the few Guantanamo detainees who has been actually assigned an attorney. Major Michael Morey was appointed by the Pentagon for Hicks to have a military tribunal, yet unscheduled. And in The Guardian on Thursday, March 25th, in an article by Tanya Brannigan, U.S. Major Attacks Guantanamo Justice, she speaks specifically of Major Michael Morey, as he states, "The system is not set up to provide even the appearance of a fair trial." Now, this is a U.S. Major appointed by the Pentagon to defend one of the Guantanamo detainees before the tribunal, and he is admitting that there is no fairness. The major said he was afraid the prosecution would present hearsay evidence in statements taken from detainees who he would be unable to cross-examine. Again, This is a U.S. major appointed by the Pentagon. And his conclusion? No fair trial. No justice. I think, Ralph, that it's best to go to another harrowing series that appeared in The Observer, the British publication, October 19th, 2003. Again, a two-part series, and this time by Mark Bowden. It's called The Persuaders. When does coercion become torture, he asks. Ralph?
Well, he's an award-winning journalist, and he's a very conservative figure who actually tries to provide a justification for subjecting people to the unspeakable treatment that he describes. Nonetheless, he has to conclude that the treatment of these people has become a breach of common humanity. And he describes the putative detention of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is supposedly one of the key figures in Al-Qaeda and second in command to Osama bin Laden itself, who we were told, as you recall in the press, roughly awakened by a raiding party of American commandos, who entered loud and fast, found him asleep, pulled him from his bed, hounded, bound, hustled from the house, placed in a vehicle, etc., etc. All of this apparently a complete fabricated scenario, as Mark Bowden documents. In fact, Sheikh Mohammed had been captured months before the March 1st date, and indeed, Abdul Qaddus, the owner of the home, stated that Sheikh Mohammed had not been there then or ever. The official video of the snatch, as the article describes in the Observer, had been faked. But he says, whenever, wherever, and however the special forces of the U.S. got control of this man, he has been and is in U.S. custody for some time. And it describes how when they grabbed him, wherever they did, and it's very evocative here because it suggests that he'd had a long association with American intelligence. Indeed, he may well have been one of the people who they had penetrated and monitored and operated. It is the look of a man awakened into a nightmare. Everything that was giving his life meaning, his role as a husband and father, his plans, his ambitions, finished. And it describes the particular type of torture to which this person was subjected.
Yes, Ralph. Psychic torture particularly. As Bowden writes, it doesn't much matter where he was because the place would not have been familiar identifiable to him. Place and time, the anchors of sanity, were about to become unmoored. He might as well have been entering a new dimension. Ralph?
Yes, it's described compellingly. A strange new world. His every word, move, and sense and sensation monitored and measured. Things seemed to be what they were not. And indeed, there was no such thing as night or day or normal patterns of eating and drinking and waking and sleeping, where hot and cold and wet and dry and clean and dirty and truth and lies are totally tangled and distorted by his controllers. He describes what he calls a fiendish torment. Intelligence and military officials of the United States have kept him under these conditions in perpetuity. His wife and children were arrested with him months before. He was continually informed that they themselves would be tormented and tortured. He was locked naked in a cell with no trace of daylight. The space filled night and day with harsh light and noise. As the cell so small that he could not stand upright, he could not sit, he could not recline. He was kept awake and cold and wet. If he managed to doze, he was roughly awakened. He was fed infrequently and irregularly with thin, baseless meals. He would go for long periods of days with questioning nonstop. Days would then go by with this continuing. The human mind, the author says, craves routine and can adjust to almost anything. So these jailers took care to permit no semblance of routine to develop. It is a sustained, fiendish torture of an individual by calculated design, and one that Kofor Black brags about, not only in the 9/11 hearings, but with the gloating cretin Bush, stating how they're finding out what the coalition is capable of doing. They're capable of emulating the Nazi torturers of Auschwitz and Maidenbeck.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoen
and Maya Schoen on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the internet at www.wbai.org. Our program today, The Formula for Totalitarianism, Torture, Repression, and the Martial Law State. Again, Ralph, in this two-part series, Mark Bowden goes into great detail about the interrogation techniques used by the U.S. Special Forces in Afghanistan, used in Guantanamo, used when they capture people such as Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and used against the 680 people in Guantanamo.
At Camp X-Ray, specifically. And what's also interesting about the description, this Mark Bowden two-part article, is that the number of people who they have detained across the world is it's well over 6,000 people, and some estimate as many as 30,000 people held in undisclosed centers at Air Force bases in Diego Garcia Military Base, at Air Force stations, at secret torture and detention centers across the planet. This is indeed Operation Torture by the U.S. Imperium with impunity. And when we look at what they're preparing under the Patriot Act, and when we understand what they mean by the Armageddon that will require the suspension of constitutional rights and the elimination of Congress, you can understand that the treatment of those on the other side of our border, including American citizens who are called enemy combatants, is but a preparation for what they intend for our citizenry at home.
Ralph, the use of drugs is also part of the interrogation technique. As the article states, on occasion, he might be given a drug to elevate his mood prior to interrogation. Marijuana, heroin, and sodium pentothal have been shown to overcome a reluctance to speak, and methamphetamine can unleash a torrent of talk in the stubbornest subjects, the very urgency of the chatter making a complex lie impossible to sustain. These drugs could be administered surreptitiously with food or drink, and given the bleakness of his existence, they might even offer a brief period of relief and pleasure, thereby creating a new category of longing and new leverage for the interrogators. And as time goes on, the prisoner, in this case he's referring to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, would grow more and more vulnerable to manipulation. Key associates might be said to be cooperating. In other words, false information is fed to the captive. And some of this information would be that their associates had completely recanted their allegiance to jihad, or that they had said things that implicated the prisoner. Isolated, confused, weary, hungry, frightened, and tormented, the prisoner is gradually reduced to a seething collection of simple needs, all of them controlled by the interrogator. The key to fulfilling all those needs is the same, to talk. Now, one thing that's interesting in this two-part series is the great amount of detail that he goes into about the role of the Shabak, the Israeli intelligence services, and what they perfected against the Palestinians. And in fact, he speaks at length with one of the major Israeli interrogators, and this is Kubi, his name is, and Ralph.
Yes, Maya, you're describing Michael Kubi, but let me just mention the following, amplifying what we were discussing a moment ago. 42 nations. These detainees are taken out of 42 nations, as the account by Bowden documents: Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Sudan, Syria, Jordan, Morocco, Yemen, Singapore, the Philippines, Thailand, Iraq, and up to 42 nations. They are, and it states following some, the following rather importantly. Captured accused terrorists, names and arrests are staged. That is to say, they are held for months before their arrests are staged. So what we are being treated to is the timing of putative arrests for political ends, when in fact people are being rounded up on a continuous basis. September last year, testifying before the House and Senate Intelligence Committee, Kofor Black, the U.S. State Department's coordinator for counterterrorism, stated that the number that had been detained under his authority alone exceeded 3,000. That does not include Central Intelligence, Defense Intelligence, Drug Enforcement Agency, the special forces that are in operation in these countries. And indeed, Kofor Black stated, when it comes to the treatment of people, it's what we call a bit of smacky face, as the Wall Street Journal gloatingly called it. Torture is what Dowden describes. Quote, after 9/11, the gloves were off. And indeed, the description in the Washington Post by Dana Priest and Barton Gellman, which is cited again in the article by Dowden, describes a continuous maltreatment of prisoners on a scale not undertaken before. And that is where Michael Kuby comes in, Maya, and the Shabbat.
Before you go into Michael Kuby, I'd like to mention that at the end of December of 2002, we prepared a show, Without Restraint, about torture. And I recommend that people listen to that to get more about what was happening in Afghanistan in particular.
The archetype of the modern interrogator, Michael Kuby, the chief interrogator for Israel's General Security Services, or the Shabak.
Now retired,
but consulted and engaged in oversight for the special forces torture. He has, quote, a uniquely twisted perspective on human nature. For decades, he has been experimenting with captive human beings, tricking, hurting, threatening, steadily upping the pressure, examining and finding cracks in the seams of each individual, taking particular pleasure and delight in the skills that he uses in applying tricks he has learned over the years in tormenting and manipulating people. He doesn't just question subjects, he orchestrates an emotional surrender. This is an artist of torture, an artist of fiendish torment, an artist of sustained breaking down of human beings. Quote, people change when we get them in prison. The conditions are different. They are afraid of the unknown. They are fearful of the torture that they will face. They try to see what it is like with a hood over their head for 4 hours. They are hungry and they are tired and they are afraid and they are isolated from everything and they have no clue what is going on. And they are sustaining sensory deprivation. They believe anything can happen. Torture, execution, indefinite imprisonment, persecution of their loved ones who we have under interrogation. Under the pressure that we apply, everyone begins to break down. And this is an almost poetic, glowing, erotic account of a torturer who is in charge and who is guiding the present operations of the totalitarian state that the United States authorities have already put into place in this society.
They have it down to a science. He says, for most men, the hierarchy of loyalty under stress is self, group, family, and friends. And what they try to do is break down each of those relationships. The key is to find a man's weak point and to exploit it. And Kuby says there are three critical ingredients for the process: preparation, investigation, and theater. And theater is a major part of what they do. For instance, they can have people with their hoods over their heads lined up and then say to the group that some of them have already cooperated. We're going to release you, Kuby said to a group of men after the interrogation was over and he wasn't able to get any information. The man's associate was hooded and seated in the hallway outside the room. We are pleased with your cooperation, But first, you must do something for me. I'm going to ask you a series of questions, just a formality, and I need you to answer yes in a loud, clear voice for the recorder. Of course, these were questions, this long list, of the prisoner's name, his age, his marital status, his date of capture, the length of detainment, and so forth. So he answered in a loud voice, yes. But the friend who was in the hall didn't know that those were the questions, and he had thought his friend had capitulated. That is one of the many tricks. There's a whole list that is given in this Michael Bowden article. It's an ABC of interrogation methods of torture, and these are primarily psychological torture combined with what's called light torture, the euphemism for deprivation of food, deprivation of light, deprivation of clean facilities, deprivation of water, deprivation of sleep, deprivation of human contact. And also there are numerous instances of beatings on the soles of the feet, the use of electric torture, and so on.
And this, I have to remind our listeners, we are not giving you an account from the Nuremberg trials. We are not giving you the testimonies of Himmler and Goebbels. We are describing the ongoing practices celebrated in the bourgeois press of the United States authorities across the world. U.S. to hold detainees at Guantanamo indefinitely. Bill Deadman, the Boston Globe correspondent, on April 25th, 2004. And it describes the accounting by Paul W. Butler, the special assistant to Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, the first acknowledgement by the government that the detainees will be held without facing the military tribunals, but will be held, quote, as long as the war on terror goes on. What are they talking about? 30 to 40 years? Indefinite. And it acknowledges the following. Over 10,000 such detainees were scooped up in Afghanistan and Pakistan alone, which gives us a sense of the volume of this activity, for which 30,000 is a number that is spoken of as minimal. 10,000 in two countries alone, subject to the kinds of conditions that we are describing here from the horse's mouth, from the authorities themselves, from the bourgeois press, elaborately, with particularity, with dates, with names, with places, with detail. The pain of one. The war and terror has changed to torture. ABC News, Andrew Chang, August 13th, 2003. Beating, asphyxiation, electrocution, starvation, and sexual violation is the subheading of the ABC News bland account of how the war on terror, as they call it, has become a process of torture. And it quotes Rumsfeld in a press conference in the Pentagon in January. Our treatment of detainees is proper and appropriate. He and Rumsfeld rebuffs any allegations of maltreatment, and when it comes to the question of torture, I won't even use the word. I won't allow you to use the word. You can call it the T word, Rumsfeld says. They won't now even allow the treatment that we're describing here to be characterized or referred to or stated for what it is, unrelenting torture. And Dana Priest and Barton Gellman in the Washington Post have characterized this stress and duress tactics that amount to systematic torture. No ambiguity about this.
Ralph, we've spoken of Afghanistan. We've spoken of Guantanamo. Now let's turn for a moment, before we go back to other subjects, to Iraq, because another harrowing instance of torture, and this is torture to the point where someone was in a coma, was published. It's called Hideous Evidence, U.S. Military Tortures Iraqis with Electricity, by Dar Jamal, and it was published in Iraq Electronic on January 9th, 2004. And it's the case of Sadiq Zoman Ibrahim, 55 years old, who was found in a coma in Tikrit Hospital. He was detained last August in Kirkuk by U.S. soldiers during a home raid which produced no weapons. He was taken to the police office in Kirkuk, was questioned by the U.S. soldiers there, then transferred to the Kirkuk Airport Detention Center. And he was then brought to the hospital in a coma. His family had a lot of difficulty tracking him down. But what took place with photos that are published in the article, photos taken by the Red Crescent, is in, we would like to think is unbelievable, but is only too believable after you read the harrowing reports of the treatment by the U.S. interrogators. The doctors at the hospital did a diagnostic test to figure out why he was in a coma. The U.S. soldiers had said he'd had a heart attack. But they found out that his heart was functioning perfectly, yet the man was in a coma. But further investigation showed what had happened to him. The inevitable conclusion was that this man was tortured, and tortured brutally. He was in unrecoverable state. And
he was in a vegetative state. And this article describes head trauma, electrocution, electrical shock bruises on his arms, his legs, his torso, while his heart is functioning normally in a vegetative state of coma in response to the shock, the torture, and the torment to which he had been subjected until he disintegrated.
Now, this is only one instance of what is taking place in Iraq as we speak. So when they go before people like Michael Ratner, wonderful civil rights attorney, go before the Supreme Court to question the rule of law in Guantanamo, and when other attorneys go before the Supreme Court to question the detention of Padilla and Hamdi as enemy combatants, when the Supreme Court considers in a very dry fashion the questions of the legal issues, we have to keep in the back of our mind the actual circumstances of these prisoners that are being detained by the United States. Ralph?
Semper Fi, patriotic torture. April 16th, 2004, Oliver North, Semper Fidelis. The Marines have a history of fighting terrorists dating back to 1804. We have fought terrorists and we are fighting them now in Tehran, Kuwait, Madrid, Beirut, Bogota, San Salvador, Frankfurt, West Berlin, Riyadh, Tehran, Nairobi, Dar es Salaam, and Aden, to name just a few places. Always faithful to the commanders, to the mission, to the nation, to the task of carrying out our counter-terror operation on a global scale. We have made great progress in every country, Oliver North describes on April 16th of this year, and it's instructive because it is the same Oliver North who has been disclosed in Nightline, the Ted Koppel Nightline on ABC, celebrating the Armageddon plan disclosed by Atlantic Monthly for the month of March, an Armageddon plan which represents the following. Point men Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, they are one person in essence, who since 1980, under a secret executive order of Ronald Reagan, have been operating a plan for a bunker-run military martial law government in which Congress is suspended, in which the Constitution is scrapped, in which the presidency is removed, in which the authority has passed to a collection of 50 to 60 national security functionaries holed up in bunkers, rehearsing twice a year. And Oliver North was the author of this in a special executive order of the Reagan administration. Oliver North, the point man for this. Now, not just a historic event, not just an account in March of this year in Atlantic Monthly, but a preparation in anticipation of the inevitable terror attack which Condoleezza Rice the next day after the Nightline broadcast described as inevitable, to be followed the day after by a Bush press conference in which he declared that the intelligence agencies are good, but they're not perfect, and that there will be a major terrorist attack to disrupt the elections, the same theme as Condoleezza Rice. The totalitarian state that is being applied in its torture application in countries across the world, with tens of thousands of detainees, with undisclosed centers of torment such as we have described today, with only a small portion of the evidence in front of us. We would need three shows to give you a full accounting of this. Is a rehearsal, brothers and sisters. They have had in mind 9/11 itself, the false flag operations that we have been subjected to, the terrorizing of the American people, the using of the state apparatus to accomplish this. This is a class war on the people of the United States. And it's interesting to note, I have to add, that the Patriot Act, which had been subject to criticism and had been subject to nitpicking, because that's about what it amounts to from those who have been criticizing it within the Democratic Party, has now undergone a revision. It seems now that the John Kerry and the Democratic Party have decided that the Patriot Act should not be opposed, but on the contrary, the police state in place should be enhanced. And the news reports in the Los Angeles Times describe how John Kerry and the Democratic Party are no longer intending to criticize the Patriot Act provisions that we have been describing here, but on the contrary, to say that they are not stringent enough.
Ralph, you're referring to an article that appeared April 25th, 2004, by Peter Walston, a Times staff writer, entitled Politics of Patriot Act, Turn Right for Bush. He starts, only months ago, Democrats were targeting the controversial U.S. Patriot Act as an ideal issue to use in their campaign against President Bush, assailing the law as an intrusion on civil rights. But in a turnabout, the act has suddenly emerged as a cornerstone of Bush's reelection campaign, while Democratic rival Senator John F. Kerry and others have toned down their criticism. It's interesting because the Patriot Act comes up for extension in 2005, and the discussion now is not about overturning it, but about continuing the Patriot Act. Now, remember that part of the hearings have been the key provision of a wall, the old wall, that so-called wall, which actually didn't really exist, but is a term that John Ashcroft and others have liked to use about the limiting of sharing of information between the criminal and intelligence investigators.
That was the code language in the 9/11 hearings, the supposed wall between the operation of the intelligence agencies and their application to civil and criminal proceedings in the United States, which means the techniques of Guantanamo. You don't confront your accuser. You're not entitled to due process. You don't have the right of an attorney. That's what it means to break down the wall between the intelligence operations who accuse people, who gather information about them, who spy on them without restraint. And you have no opportunity to separate that practice from the application of the criminal justice system in the United States.
Now, talking about the intelligence operations, a key discussion that is going on now with the FCC has to do with wiretapping. And in preparing for the show, we came across the statistics. There have been 4.4 million authorized wiretaps in 2002. Now, these are only those that have been authorized, 2.2 million by the U.S. administrative courts and 2.2 million authorized by FISA, the federal security courts. And what's going on now is the intelligence agencies, which are limited to wiretapping phones and cell phones, want this extended to the internet and messaging access. In other words, any new technology that emerges, they want to be able to have wiretapping privileges, and also they want it without the authorization of the courts. 4.4 million authorized wiretaps. We can only speculate on the numbers of millions of wiretaps that have gone unauthorized.
What they're demanding, according to the article by Ben Chamney in the CNET News of February 13, 2004, is to allow protocol VoLTE providers to permit the Federal Bureau of Investigation to monitor and to register all communications on the Internet and to amplify the right to burglarize and invade homes without notification to people to all communications on the Internet, no less than on the telephone. It is the legitimizing of state terror. It is the application of the totalitarian state. It is the implementation of what was described, as I mentioned, by Nightline on April 7th, 2004, of standing plans of the program to discard Congress, to suspend the Constitution in the event of a major terrorist attack again, which is almost a matter of not if but when, as they state repeatedly. That is what is at stake, brothers and sisters, and that gives, to my judgment, particular importance to the call of the longshore workers, ILWU Local 10, for a million worker march on Washington on October 16th to defend our rights, to assert our own agenda, for working people to answer the summons of Martin Luther King 36 years ago, and to oppose what Martin Luther King called the state of the authorities in this country, the most massive and pervasive purveyors of violence in the world. That is our task.
Ralph, another task is for everyone to show up at the court hearings for Lynn Stewart. Lynn Stewart, the defender of all of us in the case that John Ashcroft has brought against her. Please
a signature case, the heroic Lynn Stewart, who is fighting the battle to expose the false flag operation of 1993 in the World Trade Center, the hand of the government, and that's why she herself is under assault, because she is defending the falsely accused in a government operation. It is essential that this case is on our calendar, and that everybody shows up at that courtroom.
Please go to www.lynnstewart, that's LynnStewart.org, to get the date of the next court hearing. You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Rob Schoen
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Formula for Totalitarianism, Torture, Repression, and the Martial Law State, will be available on our website, www.takingaim.info. If you want an audio tape or cassette, audio tape cassette or CD copy, please write to us at takingaim@wbai.org or takingaim@pacbell.net or P.O. Box 6345, Vallejo, California, 94591. You can telephone us at 707-552-9995. We'll be with you next week.
Contact your unions, your locals, your organizations, your community groups, the Million Worker March on Washington, October 6th. Get on board.